Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Anna Arsting Kerslake about her new book, Restoring Voice to the People with Cognitive Disabilities, Realizing the Right to Equal Legal Recognition Before the Law. Anna, welcome to the show. Now, Anna, I'm wondering if we can begin the interview by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yes. I am originally from California and did my law degree in New York, where I actually happened to be there at the same time that the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities was being drafted in the UN. And that was sort of the beginning of my career as a disability human rights academic and activist. After that, I went on to work with Human Rights Watch in Brussels for some time, and then got a position at the National University of Ireland as a research fellow working specifically on the right to legal capacity and the right to be equally recognized before the law, and looking specifically at disability. And that's kind of where my interest in this area came from, and sort of where my career really evolved from. Now, of course, I am an associate professor at Melbourne Law School, where all my research, writing and teaching centers around the rights of people with disabilities.
Wow, it's a very rich career already. And can you tell me a little bit about how you came to write Restoring Voice to the People with Cognitive Disabilities?
Yeah, of course. So I have covered a little bit of this in the preface to the book, but I'll just give you an overview here. Basically, the process of writing the book started with my PhD research, which I did in Ireland, also in Galway at the National University of Ireland. But the knowledge and the experience that I hopefully have brought out in the book comes from a more personal place. My sister has Prader-Willi syndrome. And she's 2 years younger than me, so we grew up together. And Prader-Willi syndrome is a disability where the individual often has a low muscle tone and also does not have the same hormones that most people have that tell them when they're full. So it's really difficult to exercise because you have low muscle tone, and you also have low metabolism. So it's difficult to exercise. You gain weight faster, and you're hungry all the time. There's some other things as well, but those are the aspects that are most relevant for what ultimately developed into my interest in writing this book. And that is that the combination of being hungry all the time, having low muscle tone, and not being able to exercise, and low metabolism, means that making decisions related to food is very difficult for people with Prader-Willi syndrome, and even can result in their death. because they overeat until their stomach explodes. This has happened to many people with Prader-Willi syndrome. So it's kind of, it's life or death decision-making that people with disability, with Prader-Willi syndrome are forced to make on a daily basis. And throughout my life, the way my parents brought up my sister and I is that, everybody gets to make their own decisions and we live with them. But we also support each other in making those decisions. So nobody was making decisions for Sarah, essentially. Sarah is the name of my sister. Instead, Sarah was making her own decisions regarding food and doing the best she could, not always making the right decisions. And the rest of us were there to support her. Of course, it was never a perfect process. I think decision-making for anyone is never a perfect process. But those were the skills that Sarah developed throughout her life. And me, only being 2 years older than her, I never thought that was exceptional. When I got older, and when Sarah got older, we realized how exceptional our situation truly was, especially for someone with Prader-Willi syndrome, but also for people with disabilities, especially cognitive disabilities more broadly. When Sarah was around 25, she wanted to move out of home and she wanted to live in a group home. And it was her choice. She researched the group home. She found which one she wanted, which was a group home specializing in Prader-Willi syndrome. We all went to visit the home with her, which was very far away from where my parents live, about a 4-hour flight away from my parents in California. My parents are in California. The home was in Wisconsin, so it was quite far away. But this is what Sarah wanted, and we all supported her in doing that. Once she got there, everything changed relating to decision-making and relating to her legal status to make those decisions for herself. At the group home, and this is common in many group homes, Sarah couldn't make any decisions related to food. The staff made all the decisions related to food and provided the food to the house residents. Sarah being one of them. And not only that, Sarah couldn't leave the house. She couldn't go on a walk unless there was a staff member available to go with her. She also always wanted to work in childcare setting and was led to believe she would be able to do that, be able to be supported to do that at some point while living at the group home. Instead, everybody was bused together to a sheltered workshop every day where your only option was to kind of work on this more or less assembly line that they had, or you could sit with your head down on the table in the corner. So Sarah's decisions were completely, her right to make decisions for her life was completely removed from her. And she was completely de-skilled in decision-making. Her mental health deteriorated ultimately, she tried to commit suicide several times. Of course, there's a longer story behind this as well, but this is the shorter version. At the same time that this was happening, I was in law school and I knew I wanted to do social justice work. And I realized how important the legal right to make decisions in your own life, especially decisions that have legal implications. I realized how important that is. And when I began researching about the right, about what that right is, if there is a right, if in fact a right to make your own decisions even exists, I found that actually relatively little attention had been given to the right to make your own decisions in academic literature, but also more broadly in human rights law. And I think that's largely because most of the people that are writing, drafting, and dealing with human rights law and the creation of human rights law are not people that belong to populations at high risk of having their decision-making removed from them. And those there's lots of different groups, but people with disabilities would, I would say, be at the top of that list of people being at risk of having their decision-making removed from them. Realizing that in my research, I also came across the new Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities that I mentioned earlier, which is the newest UN human rights treaty, which was adopted by the General Assembly in 2008. And it is the only treaty that finally really solidifies and provides detail to the right to legal capacity, which is the right to make legal decisions and the right to be recognized as a person before the law. And those are the rights that are necessary for someone like my sister to be able to make decisions about where she works, about what food she eats every day, about where she lives and who she spends time with. It's essential for her to have the right to legal capacity recognized in order for her to be able to make the decisions that she wants to make on a day-to-day basis. And that's important, not just as a sort of formality of rights recognition for an individual. It's important for their overall well-being, for their mental health, and for their ability to participate in society on an equal basis. So that maybe was a long-winded way to give you.
No, it's really interesting
on where on why I was sort of inspired to look further into the right and to write the book about what the right to legal capacity is, why that right establishes a right to make legal decisions for yourself. And what the implications are for that. Does that answer
your question? That's really interesting. Can you, for non-disability scholars, can you talk a little bit more about what legal capacity is?
Sure. So legal capacity is essentially it's the right to be a person before the law and an actor under the law. So it really is the law's recognition of you as a legal entity. Interestingly, a whole bunch of work has been done over the past 50 years in particular on the right of corporations to legal capacity. And the work I'm doing on the right of people with disabilities to legal capacity is essentially the same thing. I'm simply looking at the concept of legal capacity and saying, why aren't people with disabilities given the same pathway, the same recognition as a legal entity with legal capacity as other individuals, and in fact, as corporations, because the sort of development of the law around the legal capacity of corporations is that corporations essentially do have legal capacity. They can, in a number of different circumstances, be recognized as legal persons. And interestingly, and potentially problematically, there's many times that people with disabilities, in fact, aren't recognized as legal persons. Would examples help of legal capacity?
Yeah. So I'm quite interested. Based on your introduction and also your book, you do talk about there's these hard cases in terms of people being denied legal capacity.
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested in how you see the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, how it can provide support for capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So I think some of the I'd say some of the most difficult decisions related to capacity, related to legal capacity, are around mental health law. I think that's a big one. Mental health law and also sort of institutional settings in general. So, and by institutional settings, I mean psychiatric residential settings, but also group homes, like the one that I mentioned before that my sister was living in. So in these settings, it's very common for the institutional structure to be sort of vested with the legal capacity of the individuals living there or being treated there. So for example, my sister was the first person ever in the group home that she lived in. She was the first person to not be placed under guardianship at the point of entering into it. So everyone else that had ever lived there had already been under guardianship when they moved into that group home. And guardianship means, it varies a bit depending on what jurisdiction you're in, but guardianship usually means that either a court or another individual is allowed to make all legal decisions for you. Sometimes there's limited guardianship where they're only allowed to make a certain range of decisions or certain types of decisions. But essentially your legal capacity, your legal decision-making is removed from you and placed in the hands of another individual or the court. And of course, in psychiatric settings, that's even more pronounced. It is almost always the supervising psychiatrist or someone else in the administration of the institution or treatment center who has the right to make decisions on the behalf of the individuals within that are being treated there or living there. And that is essentially the removal of legal capacity from the individual and the placement of their legal capacity in the hands of the institution or the psychiatrist or other administrative body. So what that means in practice is that you have very little power over what happens to you. So for example, if you're under guardianship and you want to move homes, you want to leave the group home you're living in, you're not actually recognized as a legal person who can extinguish a contract or start a new contract with a new new group home or a new house or a new landlord. It would be only the person who is your guardian that can make that decision for you. There's a really interesting case, Jenny Hatch. I don't know if you are familiar with that case.
I'm not familiar with that.
So Jenny is a woman who lives in, I believe it's upstate New York. And she has Down syndrome. And similar to my sister, had lived all her life making her own decisions and had never been under guardianship and had a really wonderful place in her community. She worked at a local secondhand shop. She went to church every week. She rode her bike around around town and got around on her own. When she was in her 20s, I believe, she got in a car accident. She was on her bike, I believe, and a car hit her and she was hospitalized. At that point, her support needs increased. Sort of one thing led to another. And ultimately, her mother, I believe, was seeking guardianship over her. And seeking to place her into a group home. The court at the time granted guardianship, removed Jenny from the community she was living in very successfully and placed her into a group home, which is very similar to the one that my sister was living in which she couldn't go out on her own. She couldn't, make her own decisions. Similar to my sister, her mental health deteriorated significantly and quite quickly. In that instance, her legal capacity was removed and placed in the guardian, which was her mother at the time. So her mother could make all legal decisions for her, essentially. And she did not have power to challenge that. That's another really, really problematic aspect of legal capacity denials for people with disabilities, and particularly in the mental health setting and in many institutional settings such as group homes, is that there's very few avenues to challenge that removal of your legal capacity. Just to finish on a positive note, Jenny's story is a happy one. Ultimately, she found a friend, a couple friends, to support her to go all the way to through the court system in New York to challenge the guardianship. Ultimately, the court didn't remove the guardianship order. However, they did place the guardianship in the hands of her friends and included in the order that they had an obligation to support her to the greatest degree possible before making a decision on her behalf. The judge seemed to feel that he couldn't make any other ruling, that he had to follow the guardianship laws as they exist in New York and had to, didn't have reason to completely lift the guardianship order or didn't have enough freedom to do that anyways, but could add to it a commentary that there was a requirement to provide as much support as possible. And that's exactly what the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities adds to the right to legal capacity. So as I mentioned before, it establishes really, I mean, establishes is the wrong word. It solidifies that there is a right to legal capacity, which is a right to make legal decisions for yourself. And then it also includes a state obligation to provide access to support for the exercise of that legal capacity. In other words, access to support for making legal decisions. And the judge in Jenny's case was recognizing that new international state obligation, although sort of conflict of laws issues between international law, state law, and federal law in the United States, the judge did not feel he could fully return Jenny's legal capacity to her. However, he did feel that he could make it clear that support is required for decision-making in cases such as Jenny's. Does that make sense?
No, it really does. It's really interesting because I think people are being denied their legal capacity, but it's also meaning not just their right to enter into legal contracts is taken away, but their day-to-day decision-making power is taken away, which is, I think, hugely problematic. Like, for example, I can choose when to eat breakfast. I can choose what to eat, but people in institutions are being denied these opportunities. I think it's really interesting what you're saying. It's kind of a blanket denial of capacity, is a denial of also how to choose how to live as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And you can see that, or you can imagine the implications that has for a person's self-worth and self-esteem.
Absolutely.
And sort of their feeling as a human who participates in society. If you can't make decisions about who you are and what you do every day, it really quickly leads to strong feelings of disempowerment.
Absolutely. And can you talk a little bit more about how the convention, kind of supports these rights? I know you talk a lot in your book about the right to legal capacity from Article 12. I'm interested because you said that the judge felt he was somewhat bound by the guardianship laws in place. What can the convention do to kind of, direct states in terms of reforming the law, I guess?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about the Article 12 of the convention, and then I will tell you a little bit about what that means for domestic law. and what that might mean for the lives of people with disabilities then. So the Article 12 is the right to equal recognition before the law, which is originally found in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and was then made legally binding by the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. And then in the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, we find the most recent emanation of that right in Article 12. So interestingly, the right to be the right to equal recognition before the law in the Universal Declaration and in the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights is relatively underexplored. In academia, as well as in international human rights, as well as in international human rights law, it sort of is sitting out there as maybe an assumption that everyone is equal before the law. Interestingly, it was the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women that first sort of picked up on the issue of equal recognition before the law and tied legal capacity to equal recognition before the law. So we first see the right to legal capacity described actually in the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. It's relatively brief, and it in that convention, and it focuses mostly on inheritance and financial and contract rights of women, sort of establishing that women have an equal right to contract, essentially, as men, as everyone. The Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities then picks up on that and goes farther than the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. So the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities in Article 12 includes the right to legal capacity as part of the right to equal recognition before the law. And it says that controversially, in the drafting process, it doesn't specifically say that legal capacity means both personhood and agency. There was quite heated debate during the drafting of the convention related to whether legal capacity simply means the right to be a person before the law, or whether the right to legal capacity means both the right to be a person before the law and to exercise legal agency. The significance of that is that you can be a person before the law, you can be recognized as a person before the law, and yet not be allowed to exercise your legal agency. So, for example, my sister could be recognized as a legal person, and yet the group home could be given the right to exercise legal agency on her behalf, which would effectively take away all her decision-making power, even though she's recognized as a legal person. If she can't exercise that legal agency, she can't enact any of the decisions that she wants to make, any of her wishes. In the creation of Article 12 and in the debates in the drafting of Article 12, there was a group of people who wanted to restrict legal capacity to simply legal personhood. There was a very strong disability rights and disability community push against that. And what the disability community was asking for is that legal capacity be considered to include both the right to personhood and the right to legal agency. They weren't able to agree that that specific text would be included in the article. However, they were able to agree that there wouldn't be any text specifically limiting legal capacity to personhood. They also agreed on text within Article 12 that specifically says that people with disabilities have a right to exercise legal capacity in relation to financial issues and contracting on an equal basis with others. And what we can extrapolate from that is that the right to legal capacity does in fact include agency as well as personhood. And you can also extrapolate that assumption from CEDAW, from the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, where the right to legal capacity also includes the right to exercise agency in financial and contracting matters in particular. So that's why Article 12 is important and significant. And the additional significance, which I mentioned earlier, is that it also requires that state obligation to provide support. So the second question is, so this all sounds great from on a theoretical perspective at the level of international human rights law, but what does that mean for domestic courts, and what does that mean for individuals with disabilities who would like to have those rights realized? And at the domestic level, it means something different in every jurisdiction, depending on how international law is incorporated into domestic law. However, without getting into an entire lecture on international law and how it works.
It's interesting, though.
It is. One good example is actually the United States and New York. So the United States has one of the most laws in relation to, is one of the jurisdictions with the most limiting practices in relation to incorporating international law into domestic law. They essentially won't do it. The only way it can be done is if a piece of domestic legislation specifically enacts the text from international law, essentially. So you can imagine how difficult that is and how infrequently that actually happens. That being the case, the concepts from international law can, however, be very influential in both courts and in legislation and in the drafting of domestic legislation in a jurisdiction like the United States. And I'm using that as an example, because it is one of the most restrictive in terms of incorporating international law. So in jurisdictions where international law can be incorporated upon ratification of a treaty, you have much less difficulty because then the treaty can, in theory, be adjudicated in the domestic courts directly. Many more jurisdictions are in the situation of the United States where international law does not become domestic law immediately upon ratification. That being the case in the United States, there's actually been some really interesting innovations, one of them being the Jenny Hatch case that I mentioned earlier, but some others being also in New York, actually in New York City, though. The surrogates court in New York City was fortunate enough to have as its lead judge, Justice Kristen Booth Glenn. And this was about, I'd say this was around almost 10 years ago now, wow. that Justice Kristen Booth Glenn, who I also happen to know very well, and I went and met with her when I was a law student, actually, and explained what Article 12 of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is and why New York law was not in compliant, because New York law at the time, and actually I believe still, includes a relatively restrictive guardianship law, which allows legal capacity to be removed on the basis of disability. So it allows another individual to become or to hold full legal capacity and to be able to make all legal decisions on behalf of a person simply on the basis of disability, but essentially it's only people with disabilities that would be subject to that guardianship law. So I went and explained to Justice Booth Glenn why this was against human rights law, being a law student and relatively naive and idealistic, a wonderful combination.
I think we need more students like that, though.
it's wonderful to not really understand hierarchy and your lowly place in the world. But because I was naive and idealistic, I did take the bold move to go and visit Justice Booth Glenn and explain these things to her. And completely to her credit, she took it on board and reflected on the laws in New York, and made a few really interesting judgments where she, again, couldn't change the law, of course, because that's not the role of the court. But she said that she had to work within the laws as they are, but there was nothing to prevent her from stating the way she believes the laws should be, the limitations of the laws, and stating that there must be support provided to a maximum level before she would be willing to remove legal capacity from an individual with disability. So before she would be willing to instate a guardian, she required that there was evidence that a maximum level of support had been provided in order to enable that individual to make decisions on their own. Since then, she's written some really interesting legal journal articles as well on the subject. But I think that's hopefully a really good example of what can be done at the domestic level, even in really restrictive jurisdictions in terms of jurisdictions that don't automatically incorporate international law into their automatically or easily incorporate international law into their domestic laws. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, because I think oftentimes, you know, one frustration in, say, a common law jurisdiction is that you are somewhat limited by precedent. But I think, you know, Justice Glenn shows that you can, you know, judges, lawyers, activists can be innovative and, you know, move the law forward, even if the laws are quite restrictive.
Yeah.
So I know, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering, like, building on what you've been saying, are there any situations where either the convention or, you know, equality law would seek to limit personhood or agency of someone with a disability?
My reading on it and my argument, I guess, and this is what I write about in the book, is that the answer would be no, that the right to legal capacity, the right to equal recognition before the law, means that there should be no circumstance in which any individual has their legal capacity, their legal decision-making skills restricted or limited on the basis of disability. Now, that being said, of course, we all live with restrictions on our autonomy, restrictions on our legal capacity, that are just part of the social contract, part of living in society. So we can't all make whatever decision we want and have that enacted at any point in time. Of course, we have the criminal law that restricts us, civil law that restricts us in various ways, and absolutely the right to legal capacity of people with disabilities doesn't allow them any greater decision making, of course, than the rest of the population. However, importantly, it also doesn't allow them less. So mental health law, again, is a great example. Almost all mental health law, at least all mental health law that I know of, allows a person's legal capacity to be restricted, limited, or denied on the basis that that individual has a mental health disability. That would run counter to Article 12 of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So if we are going to remove the right to legal capacity in the context of liberty, for example. So the right to decide whether you're going to be in a psychiatric treatment center or not. So your liberty essentially to be either detained in a facility or to not be within that facility, that would only be in line with Article 12 of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities if anyone, regardless of whether they have a mental health disability, could be subject to such a law. Does that make sense?
Or, yes, it does. Yeah.
Essentially, the short answer to your question is people with disabilities, including cognitive disabilities, such as intellectual disability and mental health disability, must have the same right to legal capacity as those without disabilities, which is a great challenge to our legal systems as they currently exist in various different ways. So mental health law is one of the most striking examples, but also guardianship law, which I've talked a bit about, but also in most jurisdictions, guardianship law is premised on the person having a disability. The court will not order a guardianship, will not make a guardianship order if the person cannot be shown to have a disability. So they have to have a disability before the before their legal capacity can be removed and given to a guardian. The other area that I've done a few quite significant research projects on is the insanity defense in criminal law and and unfitness to plead laws also in criminal law. So essentially the right to enter a plea when you're charged with a crime. I believe my argument is, and there's others out there arguing the same, my argument is that the laws that don't allow, that remove someone's right to enter a plea on the basis that they have a disability are counter to the right to legal capacity. So they violate the right to legal capacity. Only thing that would be compliant with the right to legal capacity would be allowing the individual to voluntarily relinquish legal capacity to someone else, a legal representative, to go through with the trial if that's what an individual wishes, or alternatively, supporting the individual to enter a plea and go through the trial process. So they maintain their legal personhood, they maintain their legal agency, which of course, as I explained before, is their legal capacity, and they are supported to go through the trial process, which of course sounds scary and maybe sounds counter to an instinct to protect people with cognitive disabilities in particular that are charged with a crime. However, my research and many other people's research have found that in fact, in a majority of cases, when people are found unfit to plead, and that's almost always people with disabilities are found unfit to plead, they in fact receive sentences the outcome essentially is that they are detained for much, much longer than they would have been if they were allowed to go through with a trial, if they were supported through a trial. In fact, in some cases, they are detained indefinitely because there's no, in some jurisdictions, there's no provision for what should happen if an individual is found unfit to plead the trial can't go forward. So that's just another example of how important the right to legal capacity is, and how our legal system could in fact be much more efficient and much more equal if we were to really endeavor to ensure that the right to legal capacity is protected on an equal basis for people with and without disabilities.
I wholly agree with you. I think I've read the committee, I think, in relation to their guidelines on Article 14, which is the right to liberty and security of the person, have said that, you know, criminal laws apply to all people equally, including people with disabilities. And so I think it's, you know, can also be a matter of holding people accountable and supporting their capacity to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It is a friend of mine and a really wonderful scholar and activist, Tina Minkowitz, has written a lot about this. And it is, I think it's difficult for some people to grapple with the idea that people with disabilities are held equally responsible, equally criminally responsible as people without disabilities. It highlights a few things. It highlights the inadequacy of our criminal justice system as a whole, I think, because when you start going down that road and you ask the question, well, why shouldn't people with disabilities be held legally responsible? Often the answer is, well, you don't want them in the prison setting. Like, it's a terrible setting to be in. It doesn't provide any support for people. It doesn't allow for, it's essentially punishment, right? It's essentially punitive measure, which of course, in theory, it's not supposed to be a wholly punitive measure. And then you ask yourself, is anybody, even those who aren't identified as people with disabilities, is being in a prison setting benefiting anyone, both either the people that are in there or society as a whole when people are placed in there. And there's some real questions that arise around that as well. So of course, it's absolutely true that every prison setting that I've ever encountered is not supportive of people with disabilities. It's not accessible. They're often not accessible settings. However, it's almost a separate issue, and it really challenged the whole criminal justice system. But it's a separate issue from whether, in theory, in principle, people with disabilities should be held criminally responsible on an equal basis with people without disabilities. And my argument is that Article 12 says they must be, and I think that challenges us then to change our criminal justice systems to ensure that they're actually supporting people to not reoffend, and supporting people to be detained in an accessible and supportive way when that is, the appropriate course. But it's quite a controversial thing that Article 12 raises, and a significant challenge to our legal systems as they exist now.
No, I think it's interesting. And one thing I like about your book is you do present these kind of concrete examples of how to improve things. And I think the point that you make is really interesting that, you know, for example, Article 12 and the Convention on the Rights with Persons with Disabilities, while it looks at making things better and more equal for people with disabilities, it also forces us to challenge the assumptions and the kind of institutions and structures that are already in place, and it shines a light on the problems with those. So in making the world better and more accommodating of people with disabilities, we're potentially making it better for everyone.
Yes, exactly. I think that's another thing that really excites me about Article 12 of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is that the challenge to create a legal system that respects everyone's legal capacity on an equal basis, it really does make us reflect on all these different areas of our law that we're not doing that. And that goes beyond disability as well. So a really interesting one, which which actually segues into what my research is looking at now. A really interesting issue is immigration law. So essentially, immigrants, both documented and undocumented, have their legal capacity denied in various different ways when they are arriving in a new jurisdiction. And I think the right to equal recognition before the law and the right to legal capacity presents significant challenges for immigration law. And what my new research is looking into is whether the right to equal recognition before the law can be squared with immigration law that limits legal capacity of documented and undocumented immigrants in various different ways. The other interesting area of the law, I think, is women's rights and the right of women to be equal before the law and have legal capacity on an equal basis. So actually the newest book that I'm working on right now is called Legal Capacity and Gender. It will be published with Springer sometime soon. And in that book, I'm looking at how the right to legal capacity is denied for women, disabled women, and gender minorities. I started this sort of journey looking at how decision making and legal capacity is denied to people with disabilities, but it really extends to so many different groups. And the strength of it, I believe, is actually if you manage to figure out how to protect the right to equal recognition before the law for everyone, I think you actually manage to solve a lot of inequality problems and a lot of discrimination problems as well. So, for example, gender minorities are having their legal capacity restricted on the basis that it's very difficult to have your gender changed. And if you're non-binary, if you identify as non-binary, to have that recognized at all in legal documents, and without legal documentation regarding your gender, which is often your identity documents, you're significantly restricted in terms of how you can exercise legal agency. So even just signing a contract, you are required any kind of contract. You're required to show legal identification, usually. If you aren't able to get legal identification because you aren't able to have your gender accurately depicted on your, accurately identified on your identification, on your legal identification, that significantly restricts your ability to contract and your ability to exercise agency in many different ways. So in my new book, that's what I'm looking at. How can we make sure that everyone has the right to exercise legal capacity on an equal basis? And how will the realization of that right solve a lot of problems we have actually in terms of marginalization of various different groups of people?
That sounds really fascinating. I'm hoping that maybe once it's published, we can chat again and
do
another recording. Yeah, great. Well, thank you very much for your time. I've learned so much today, and I'm sure all the listeners have as well. And we will look forward to your new book.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about my book.